From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 100 years ago this summer, Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece, the Mona Lisa, was stolen from the Louvre in Paris. Taken right off the wall, just lifted off of four simple hooks. There wasn't much in the way of security in those days. It was taken by an Italian laborer, a man named Vincenzo Perugia, who kept it in his Parisian apartment for 2 years. Then he took it to Italy, gave it back, and got arrested. Today in the program, we're telling this story. Our guest is the writer Joe Medeiros, who's been obsessed with the heist for years and years. For Medeiros, there are two main characters here. Perugia himself, who had complicated reasons for doing what he did. But it's also about the Mona Lisa itself and why the painting was and remains so captivating. So stay with us. We're back after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you've been to the Louvre to see the Mona Lisa with its bulletproof glass and security guards, it's hard to imagine how easy it was to steal it 100 years ago. In August of 1911, an Italian laborer named Vincenzo Perugia slipped into the museum on a Monday. That was the day it was closed for cleaning. He lifted the painting off of four simple hooks, covered it with the worker's smock he'd been wearing, and after a few hitches, he walked out with it. Perugia kept the painting to himself, stashed it in his simple Parisian apartment, and when he gave it back in Florence, Italy, some 2 years later, he was immediately arrested. Today in the program, we're telling this story. Our guest is the writer and filmmaker Joe Medeiros, who has been fascinated by the tale for years. This is more than just about a heist. It's about the painting itself and the complicated reasons Perugia had for taking it. Joe Medeiros is a writer and a filmmaker, as we said, for nearly two decades. He was the head writer of The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. He has written and produced a documentary film about the theft of the Mona Lisa called The Missing Piece, and he's joining us here in the studio. And Joe Medeiros, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug. It's great to be here.
Well, let me start. I wanted to ask you about something you say in the film, and you've been thinking about this for a long time. For as long as you can remember, you say you've been fascinated by the Mona Lisa.
Right.
Why? And do you think you figured out why?
Well, you know, I was fascinated with Leonardo da Vinci, you know, initially.
Yeah.
You know, the genius that he was, the multi-talented, you know, genius. And the fact that the Mona Lisa, I've always been intrigued with, like everyone else, the smile, her identity. You know, the fact that why is this painting so important?
Yeah. It's a simple painting. Why
simple
is it
painting.
So
exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, we know it, and it's sort of like, you know, this is a terrible way to go to museums, but most of us go to museums with our checklist. It's like, okay, there's the Mona Lisa, check that off. Oh, there's the Winged Victory, there's a Venus de Milo.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you go to see the greatest hits. If we had no idea who or what the Mona Lisa was and who painted it, would we be intrigued by this painting, you know, if we went into a museum? If you took a, you know, somebody from a third world country who didn't have the sort of, you know, cultural experience that we have, would they single that painting out? You know, it's a question that a lot of people ask, and I don't know how to answer it.
Right. Well, if it wasn't such a celebrity.
Right.
Yeah. So when did you find out, because this was a real turning point for you, when did you find out that it had been stolen? I think a lot of us don't – like the story sort of faded away. A lot of us didn't really know about that. When did you first learn about it?
It was the summer of 1976. I was 25 years old. I was a couple of years out of film school. And I was just thumbing through a book that I have about Leonardo. And on a page about the Mona Lisa, there was a single sentence that Vincenzo Perugia had stolen the painting to take to Italy.
Yeah.
And it's like – what? You know, I mean, I consider myself a reasonably, you know, well-read person, you know, college educated, and you know, I watch a lot of television. And, you know, you'd think that I would have known that, but I didn't. And immediately I needed to know more. So I went to, you know, as I say in my film, this was back in the days when you actually had to leave the house to get information.
Right.
You know, and I had to go to the Philadelphia Library, and I lived in Philadelphia at the time. And, you know, turning through the microfiche, I found the New York Times articles and I started taking notes.
But what was it about? I mean, yeah, it's amazing. Wow, the Mona Lisa was, but a lot of us would kind of leave it there.
Right.
Okay, wow, that's interesting. And they store it away. But that you couldn't leave it there. I mean, you kept – what was it about this story that you kept working on?
Well, I mean, that was sort of a two-pronged thing. One, I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, being a partial Italian descent, you know, that an Italian workman – you know, a simple guy. My father poured concrete for a living, so I could identify, and I did it too through my high school years. I mean, I could identify with, you know, a simple laborer, you know, and the fact that he got away with this amazing crime.
Yeah.
To me, that was the interesting part. But also, to be honest, I had an ulterior motive. You know, I thought that I would be able to fashion this story into a film script because no one had ever told this story. You know, I was just, you know, amazed that I had never heard it, that none of my friends had ever heard it, and that it seemed to be a very ripe story to tell as a feature film.
Mm-hmm.
And this was going to be my ticket to Hollywood, you know, back in 1976.
You know what's so interesting about when you talk about that you had this ulterior motive?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the film is about, the motive.
Right.
What? Why did Perugia, why did he do this? And I think it's so interesting that you yourself had sort of multiple kind of motives. Like they weren't entirely pure. This wasn't just this academic exercise for you. It wasn't just about finding out the truth. It was also about making a little bit of money. And in some ways, or at least that's initially how it was. I mean, it
initially, of course.
Right? But isn't that what Perugia sort of is?
Right.
Those are the questions relevant for his story as well.
Well, obviously, I've made a documentary about it. So making a lot of money is sort of ruled out
by of course. But it's complicated.
Right. It is complicated. And I was a young man at the time, as he was.
Yeah.
You know, all young people are looking to make their way in the world, and you really don't know. And I never really understood why this story, you know, appealed to me for that reason. But I knew I wanted to tell it. And literally, it was 30 years of nothing but failure because I would try to write this story and try to write this script, and I never understood the man. You know, I'm a 21st century guy. What did I know about an Italian immigrant, you know, 100 years ago? So I would make things up about him and his life and his story. And they never rang true. Or maybe I'm just not a good enough fiction writer. But I was never able to finish a script. Now, as far as Perugia's motivation, he was a young guy looking to make his way in the world. If you want to meet me to backtrack a little bit on he was an Italian immigrant from northern Italy.
Right.
And at the time, you know, there was very little work for people in northern Italy. They were always emigrating to France. And he was from a village where most of the men there were painters, decorators. They were hired in Paris to decorate, you know, wealthy homes, you know, offices. And so he was a decorative painter. And he went there to make his to make a splash. I mean, I read once that he said, you know, I'm leaving my hometown on foot, but I hope to come back in a car. So he was a young man with big dreams.
He wanted to make his way.
He wanted to make his way.
Yeah. So finding it seems like so the other turning point then comes. So it seems like you get hit these dead ends throughout for the years. You know, you're writing the screenplay, you're trying to figure this out, and then you come upon the fact that Perugia's daughter still alive.
That was a huge turning point. You know, my source of frustration over the years was I always wanted to be a screenwriter, but I never had the, I don't know if it's the tenacity, but the ability to sit down and write 120 pages of something. You know, I always would start and like I get 10 pages in, I throw this stinks and you throw it out and you start again. Right. So I was forever starting again. And I guess one of the reasons I became a joke writer was that I was able to write a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and I took a correspondence course in joke writing, and I started actually selling my jokes. And after doing that for a number of years, that's how I got hooked up with Jay Leno. So my joke writing and my entire Tonight Show career really came out of frustration with my inability to write this script.
Wow.
So after doing it a number of years, and I, you know, I went to school for filmmaking, and then when our digital age came about and we were able to get high-def cameras and editing programs on our own computers, I went back to making short films. And then one day my wife said, you know, maybe you ought to make a documentary, you know, about Perugia, because I had discovered that his daughter was alive. And it's like, that's it. You know, we'll go to Italy and we'll interview her and I'll get the answers from her.
It's so funny that you have this wanting to write this script. And so in the meantime, you're the head writer for the Jay Leno show. like that's sort of your night job, which is, you know, as most people would agree, that's quite a career in of itself.
So oh, yeah, it was terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was always this nagging thing in the back of my mind. It's like, why can't I accomplish this one goal that I've had since I was a young guy?
Yeah. Well, talk about going to northern Italy. This is a town called Dumenza,
right,
where Celestina and her father, they were both born there.
Right.
And you introduce us to her in the film, and she is, I have to say, you describe her as the Italian grandmother you always wanted.
Right.
Lovely and charming and just kind of adorable.
You can't help but fall in love with this woman.
Yeah.
And she was so welcoming. She had never really known her father.
Right.
And that's the one thing that is sort of the monkey wrench that gets thrown into my plans, because I'm going there to get the answers from Celestina. Why did her father steal it? What kind of guy was he?
Yeah.
And like, oh, I never knew him because he died when she was a year and a half old. But she had been told stories, you know, later in her life. It was always a big family secret, a scandal. Obviously, if you have in your family a man who stole the Mona Lisa, you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
So, and especially these Italians were very honest, you know, hardworking people. They sort of downplayed all that. So it wasn't until she was 20 that she learned, you know, about her father and what he did. So she never really had the facts either. She was told things by hearsay, by family legend. And when I went to see her, I just fell in love with her. And I actually knew more about her father than she did because of all the years of research and all the things that I read about him. So I was able to tell her things, but we both wanted to still know why.
Why? This is the thing that the film is about almost as much as anything else, is it's about this moment when you say, you kind of put your foot in your mouth, as you say in the film. You
right.
say to Celestina, I'm going to go and find out. I'm going to find out why your father did this. Now, her hunch is the charitable one. You know, she's thinking, all right, my father did this because he was a patriot. He wanted to repatriate this painting. She understood that he had been on the other end of some racial slurs, and he had a kind of an axe to grind in some ways too. But she sort of figures his motive is, if not pure, it's pretty understandable. But she doesn't know.
Right.
And it's touching, I have to say, Joe, that she wants to know the truth.
Sure.
Then you commit to telling her.
And fortunately, we do find it out.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the great discoveries of the film that I'm very, very happy that we actually stumbled on it. But yeah, as far as Perugia's motive, I mean, he worked in Paris. He became a worker in the Louvre because there was a rash of vandalism at the time. So the Louvre, in their, I guess, cost-efficient way of protecting the paintings, decided to put everything under glass.
Yeah.
And Perugia worked for the company that did the glass work in the Louvre. So obviously he was a trusted employee. He was brought in to be one of the five guys to help cut and clean the glass. So as he's working there, you know, and as you said, he was a victim of ethnic slurs. You know, he was called Macaroni.
Yeah.
You know, there were tricks played on him. They put salt in his wine. They would steal his tools. I mean, these are things that, you know, I had read about. And he saw this Italian art there, which was very high regarded.
Yeah.
And I guess there was a disconnect that sort of, well, how can, the French people put us down as Italians, yet celebrate our culture.
Right.
And he asked one of his French supervisors, how did all this work get here? And the guy would just sort of like chuckled at him. He smiled, didn't give him an answer. And then one day Perugia was leafing through a book and he saw that Napoleon had stolen a lot of art from Italy when he conquered the country in the early 1800s, which is the truth. Most of it was repatriated. There's still some things that were too big to bring back. But the Mona Lisa was not something that was stolen, but Perugia didn't know that. So this is where the patriotic angle comes from.
Yeah.
But my thing was like, you know, he was a man who had a life. If he were sitting, you know, across from me where you are, you know, I would want to understand his motive.
Yeah.
You know, he says it was patriotism. Other people said he did it just purely for money. You know, if he wanted money, there could have been a thousand other paintings that he could have stolen and sold and not created the big, hullabaloo that he did. I really wanted to understand from a human point of view, from a personal point of view.
Right.
What were you thinking? You know, what was going through your head? Why did you decide to do this? And ultimately, I think we found that in the letters that he had written to his parents.
And we'll get to that as we go. But let's talk about the theft itself. I want to talk in some detail as we go along. But sort of let's give the basics because some may not be so aware of it. This is a Monday. It's when the museum is being cleaned. He takes this as his opportunity. Give us sort of the basics. Of how it comes about.
Well, on Monday, the Louvre, if you've been to the Louvre today, you know they are closed on a Tuesday. And that's where there's general maintenance, where there's some of the cleaning. Back in 1911, it was on a Monday, and Perugia knew this because he had worked at the Louvre putting the paintings under glass. So he says, and if you could believe what he says, this is his testimony both to the police and also, and we could talk about this in detail a little later, the psychiatrist who examined him.
This is an important part.
Yeah, this is an important part of the story. But Perugia says at 6 o'clock on a Monday, he gets up and goes, today's the day. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So he walks to the Louvre. And he's got his worker's smock on. It's like a lab coat that you would see people, or an artist's smock that people wear today. And he just simply walks in through the employee entrance with the other employees, blends in. You know, nobody knows that he's not supposed to be there.
Yeah.
And he walks to the Salon Carré, which was the square salon is the translation of Salon Carré. And it's where the Louvre at the time kept some of their prized masterpieces of a number of schools. The Mona Lisa was on the center wall. He just simply lifted it off. It was in a glass frame. It was in a frame covered with glass. He took it to a staircase where he removed
it. Wait, go back because.
Yes.
Like, that's ridiculous. How easy that is. Like I said in the intro, four clips,
That's it. It was hung on a wall. It wasn't, really fastened. And the reason why it wasn't fastened was at the time, The Louvre, they weren't worried about theft. People didn't steal art back then. It was sort of something that, who does that?
Exactly.
They were worried about fire.
Yeah.
You're talking about a hundreds of years old palace, which doesn't have sprinkler systems. So they want to be sure that the paintings, in case there's an outbreak, they could grab the stuff off the wall and run to safety with it.
Got it. So he gets to the stairwell.
He gets to the stairwell, and he knew the stairwell was there, and it's in an adjoining salon because that's where the bathrooms were. And this was the access, to the different floors of the museum that the workers would take. So Perugia goes there, and he knows that there's a door at the bottom of the staircase. And he thinks that, okay, I'm going to go out this door. I'll get out a lot faster than I got in. So he goes down there, but the door is locked.
Yeah.
So he has a screwdriver with him, and he starts to take off the knob of the door. Why he did this, I don't understand. But
kind of desperate, maybe? Or
yeah, I think he was probably afraid to go out the other way.
Yeah.
So it's like, I have to get out this door. As he's doing it, somebody comes down the stairs. So Perugia sits down. It's a plumber who's just passing through. He sees Perugia sitting there, and the plumber notices that the Perugia had taken the doorknob off the door, but he wasn't able to open the lock. So the plumber sort of looks at him and says, where's the knob? And Perugia goes, hey, don't ask me. I have no idea.
Yeah.
So the plumber opens the door and then goes out and locks it behind him. So Perugia is still locked in the staircase. So he thinks, okay, this isn't going to work. So he goes back upstairs, takes the painting out of the frame, takes his blouse off, wraps it around the painting, and then walks out of the museum. Now, remember, this is a piece of wood. It's not a canvas that you can roll up. And it's 21 by 30, which is small, as paintings go, but still, it's a pretty big piece of wood.
Yeah.
You need to be able to cover this up. So Perugia wraps it around, wraps his blouse, and walks out of the museum with it.
What's the reaction? What's so interesting about the story also is the fact that they didn't realize it for a while, that, the Mona Lisa is missing.
Exactly. There were guards that would pass through the salon during that day. Now, to set that stage for you, normally during a regular day when the Louvre was open, there would be 166 guards, which is still pretty small by today's standards. But on a Monday, there were only 12, and they were dispersed on different floors through the whole museum. They weren't really guarding the paintings that day. They were there just because you had to have a skeleton staff, to let the workmen in and just to keep an eye on some of the workmen. They saw the empty space, and their first thought was not, who stole the Mona Lisa? It's, oh, I guess the photographer has her, because the photographer would often take paintings to his studio to shoot them for postcards and catalogs. So that was their first thought, and it stayed that way for the following 24 hours until the middle of the Tuesday, when the museum reopened and the patrons are coming in asking the guards, hey, where's the Mona Lisa? And, oh, she'll be back in a minute. The photographer has her. But when they went to check the photographer, he had no idea where she was.
Mm. It's so interesting that Paris, of course, is the center place of culture for the world at the mm-hmm. time. And now the Mona Lisa is missing. You talk about how Paris was rocked by all of this. And it's interesting just how much this theft, this story, plays into her celebrity status, the Mona Lisa. It kind of makes her an icon in some ways, the theft.
Yes, in many ways. At the time, people, the regular person did not go to a museum. The regular person was too busy earning a living and supporting their family to have and they usually worked 6 or 7 days a week. They didn't have the leisure time to go spending it in museums. The people that went to museums were the wealthy, those on their world tour. Artists certainly went there. Students went there. The average person may have heard about the Mona Lisa, because the average person, especially the average Italian, knew Leonardo da Vinci. Mm-hmm. You know, they knew some of his works. But to give you an idea, and this is in the film, when the Washington Post, one of our most celebrated papers, printed the story that the painting had been stolen, they ran a picture of the Mona Lisa. They ran the incorrect picture. They ran one of the nude sketches that had been done of the Mona Lisa. When I saw that, I couldn't believe it. Of course, the next day they run a retraction. Oops, sorry, we put in the wrong picture.
But it wasn't the icon at the time.
No, it wasn't. No. People may have heard about it. They didn't necessarily see it. They didn't even know how to spell it. A lot of times it's M-O-N-A-L-I-Z-A.
Yeah.
But yes, it certainly wasn't the icon. But this is what helped it become that, because once the museum reopened after an extensive search, because first of all, they didn't believe that the painting had been stolen.
It's impossible.
So it's got to be in here. We misplaced it.
Right.
Somebody's hiding it. It's a joke.
Yeah.
So they spent 8 days, tearing the Louvre apart. And when they didn't find it, they reopened the museum. And people flocked in there to see the empty space on the wall. And this is what brought in the average person. This was dinner table conversation. You know, this was cocktail party conversation. This became the story of the time.
Joe Medeiros is with us. He's a writer and filmmaker. He's written and produced a documentary film about the theft of the Mona Lisa called The Missing Piece. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're telling a story. It's the captivating tale of the theft of the Mona Lisa, stolen from the Louvre 100 years ago. In the summer of 1911, there wasn't much security for the painting in those days. It was taken by an Italian laborer named Vincenzo Perugia. And his motives are, well, they're complicated. Did he do it for his country? Did he do it for love? Did he do it for the money? Our guest is the writer and filmmaker Joe Medeiros, who's been exploring this story for decades. He's produced a documentary about it, in fact, and he's joining us here in the studio. So we should say that as soon as it happened, of course, this investigation gets underway, and there were all kinds of weird stories and rumors and theories about what had happened. And in some ways, I guess you could say, Joe, that hasn't really stopped. There's still a weird way of thinking about it today. There's still a lot of kind of misinformation about the way the story played out.
Right. There are a lot of conflicting stories. There are a lot of legendary tales. There are some that we explore in the film. But people could not believe initially that it was stolen.
Yeah.
And once they found out that it was an Italian laborer, they still couldn't believe that this guy did it.
Yeah. So there was
How could he pull it off? And that's one of the things that I when I was first studying this, and I dealt with a lot of secondary source material, some publications that were written since the theft, some written during the theft, some books written after the theft. But when I made this film, I wanted to go back and get the original primary source material because that's the closest I'm going to get to finding out what the truth is, short of having Perugia here.
Yeah.
And believe me, if a seance could have brought him back.
You would have tried it.
Yeah, I would have tried it.
You were game for anything, it seems.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, it's interesting the way society thought about who could have done this. And in some ways, Perugia sort of, he escaped attention for so long because, as you said, how could this Italian laborer have done all of this? But also their sense of class.
Exactly.
Like there were two types of criminals and high class and low class. And they figured, well, the low class wouldn't be interested in this amazing painting. Had to have been done by someone in the upper classes.
That's one thing that I was always perplexed by. Perugia was questioned by the police several months after the theft because he had worked at the Louvre.
Yeah.
You know, they had found fingerprints on the glass of the painting. They were trying to match those fingerprints. Perugia had a criminal record because of a couple of prior minor little things he got into.
Yeah, yeah.
And it always – I could never understand, well, why didn't the police put two and two together? Why didn't they suspect this man? And then in doing my research, I stumbled upon this book that was written in 1911 by a Swiss professor, R.A. Rice. And it was a manual of police scientific procedure with a foreword by Louis Lepine, who was the prefect of police at the time. He was the man that was in charge of the investigation initially.
Yeah.
And like you said, in there, I read that the police believed there were two types of criminals. Now, we're coming from the time when it was called Lombrosian technique. Now, Lombroso was a guy who would say you could identify a criminal by the way that they look.
Yeah.
You know when we get the thing, oh, he's got beady eyes, he must be a criminal?
That's from that. Huh.
So this was on the tail end of that, where a lot of people still, you know, subscribe to this way of picturing criminals. We're just on the cusp of modern police CSI type of investigation where they go by fingerprints. Now, the man who was in charge of the fingerprints in Paris was Alphonse Bertillon, very famous criminologist. He's the man that really codified the mugshot and the police record card with the mugshot on it. He was grudgingly interested in fingerprints because the English were doing it and the Spanish were doing it and even the Americans were doing it. We don't here in France don't necessarily do it. So they didn't really quite put the kind of stock into it. So Perugia, being a guy that they talked to, and they thought that he was lower class, not capable of a crime of this magnitude.
Well, there's this great story where an investigator actually comes to his apartment where he has the painting.
That's correct.
And he's eating Perugia, and he's got the thing in a closet at the time.
That's where we think it is.
Yeah.
You know, his daughter tells a story that he had it right there on the table, covered with a tablecloth, and the police detective was there, and he signed the report that the Mona Lisa is not here, right on top of the Mona Lisa. I don't think that that's quite the case, but he did have a 6x6 closet in his room where we believe that the painting was kept.
It's interesting. The French blamed the Germans.
Yes.
They blamed rich Americans. They blamed Picasso.
They blamed everybody but the man who stole it.
Yeah.
And because we're at a time prior to World War I where it was very nationalistic, very suspicious time, they finger pointed at everybody who they thought could have pulled this off.
Yeah.
And the first suspects were the Germans because they were the enemy of the day. And Picasso, because he was a foreigner, was brought in for questioning. His good friend Apollinaire was a very famous poet.
Yeah.
Apollinaire was really Polish. And the French really thought that he was the type of person who was smart enough to run an international gang to have pulled this off. They didn't think Picasso so much because Picasso's from the southern Mediterranean. They really had the prejudice against Italians, against Spanish. They thought they're very nice people. They're very sunny people. But as far as being master criminals, maybe they'll steal a loaf of bread or hit you over the head and take your wallet. But as far as pulling this off, this needs to be somebody with a mind like a German or a mind like a Belgian or a Slavic or a Pole.
Mm. It's interesting. There's this other spin you went to Cadro, Italy.
Yes.
Where all the people in that village, they don't even know who Perugia is.
Right.
They think it was a fellow by the name of Lancelotti.
The Lancelotti brothers were a couple of gentlemen who I discovered early on, and I could never understand what they had to do with the crime. Did they have anything to do with it? Were they Perugia's accomplices? Now, a lot of people, and this is written in many books, and one of the things that I tried to disprove, and I think I have, is that they said, well, Perugia couldn't have carried the painting himself because it weighed 200 pounds. And this is in some articles of the day and some articles subsequently. But I talked to people at the Louvre, you know, a man named
the curator, right?
Yeah. Vincent de Louvain, who's a, you know, very thin guy, probably, you know, 150 pounds. And he said, no, I carry this thing in the frame by myself. And he's no, you know, muscle man. So what did the Lancelotti brothers have to do with it? They were arrested after Perugia was arrested, yeah. But they were subsequently released. And I never quite understood, you know, why and how. But finding their actual police investigation and their interrogations, they were neighbors of Perugia. Yeah. And Perugia does admit giving his friend Vincenzo Lancelotti, who he played music with. Perugia was a mandolinist. And
they were good friends.
They were good friends. And Vincenzo Lancelotti was a guitarist. So he gave him the Mona Lisa to hold, he says, for 6 weeks while he built a trunk. Now, of course, the Lancelotti family says a totally different story. They said the Perugia didn't even steal the painting. It was Lancelotti who was the mastermind of the crime, and he stole the painting and he brought it to Italy.
Well, it's so interesting how one particular restaurant owner, I guess that's what he does, mm-hmm. Has sort of built this little theory up, and I guess it helps him tourism purposes, right? But it's just so interesting how many myths there are about this story.
There's quite a few. I mean, that's one that I never knew about, but I had found out online. Graziano Balinari is the gentleman that you're speaking about. And it's a story that he heard from the wife of one of the Lancelotti brothers. And we interviewed the nephew of one of the Lancelotti brothers, and he heard the same story.
Yeah.
That Vincenzo Perugia had nothing to do with the theft. It was Vincenzo Lancelotti who stole the painting. He brought it to Italy, where they hid it on a table in their father's tavern for 2 years. And then they got Perugia to hand it over and get rid of it, which is it's a great story. And if I were writing my script, you know, that would certainly be the element of it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Perugia. You're convinced, of course, that he did it. I don't think there's any doubt about that. One thing that's helped you understand a lot of the story and kind of deepened it, seems to you, was finding his psychiatric evaluation.
Right.
It was done by a man named Paolo Amaldi. And it's interesting. I guess this was the only thing the defense has when Perugia finally gets caught, is to sort of – this is kind of their insanity defense almost.
Very, very contemporary, right?
Yeah. It's all they've got.
Yeah, right. He did it because he's nuts.
Yeah.
Actually, the term that Amaldi used was he was mentally deficient.
Yeah.
Only partially responsible for his actions. That was his diagnosis of Perugia. And I had known that going in, that a psychiatrist had examined him and that he had come out with this diagnosis, but I could never square it with the facts.
Yeah.
It didn't seem that Perugia, if he were one of the five guys putting the Mona Lisa under glass, it seemed that he was a trusted, valued employee. And I have a letter that his employer had written to Amaldi saying, yeah, I trusted Perugia with the payroll. You know, if you're giving the payroll to somebody, this is somebody who's got to have, you know, his act together.
Yeah.
So I can never understand why Amaldi would say that he was mentally deficient. And how can a mentally deficient guy pull this off unless he were incredibly lucky, which I don't think he was. I think the Perugia...
And it may have been kind of easy, but it was a task to steal this painting.
And to keep it and to keep quiet,
yeah,
you know, not to tell anybody, not to do anything foolish over the 2.5 years that he had it. I mean, one of the things that I found in the documents was that it wasn't a spur of the moment decision. I really believe that Perugia planned this, because why that day? Why August 21st? You know, I knew that the reason for a Monday, but the reason for that particular day was that I had found in the documents that they were working on the glass ceiling above that part of the museum. The work finished the week before. The 21st was the first Monday when they weren't doing the work on the ceiling. And the reason why that's significant is that they used that staircase that Perugia took the Mona Lisa out of the frame to access the roof of the Louvre. Perugia must have known there wouldn't be anybody in there. That would be a safe haven for him to take the painting in there. So to me, that doesn't say mentally deficient.
Right.
So, but once I got Amaldi's report, that really gave me a lot of the background of Perugia's life, his family history, the stories about him being called Macaroni.
Right. And the lead poisoning.
And the lead poisoning. Very significant. When I read that, I thought, oh, well, here's the smoking gun.
Yeah.
Maybe this is the missing piece that I was looking for. The Perugia had lead poisoning. I interviewed a number
Which a lot of painters did, of course, in that era. That, this was lead paint.
Right. And that was the chief cause of illness among painters in Paris at the time. You know, and the painters were at the top of the list of everybody getting lead poisoning in the early 1900s. You know, it was endemic. And, yeah. and it was a very serious illness. And some of the experts who've investigated it since and have drawn the parallels between lead poisoning and impulse behavior that leads to a criminal offense.
Yeah.
And Perugia had a couple of impulsive acts that he did that ended up getting him arrested. I don't know if it's so much the lead poisoning or the fact that he had a couple of glasses of wine.
You raised that question in the film. Yeah. Right, right.
You know, young guy.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, one question I wanted to get at. So he plans this out. It's clear, as you say, he plans it out. But his decision once he gets in the room, was he always determined to get the Mona Lisa? Because in some ways it seems as though it was just another painting. Did he know the Mona? I mean, could he have stolen something else, do you think, if the mood would have struck? Or was he after the Mona Lisa, do you figure?
He says he didn't know which painting he was going to steal.
You doubt that? Or do you think that's true?
Well, I know that he wanted something small.
Yeah.
And he needed something small.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I'm working on the premise that I'm going to return this to Italy, I'm going to take something back that the Italian is going to be happy to have. Now, obviously, you can't take a big 9x16 painting. You know, the Mona Lisa is small enough to tuck under your arm and take out of the museum. It's got more bang for the buck, I guess. You know, it's the smallest painting that's the most valuable. So to me, it makes a lot of sense to take that painting if you're going to take one.
I want to ask you about how all of this plays out. I think it's kind of great if you think about it in some ways. He returns it 2 years later.
Right.
And you tell the whole story, probably longer than we have time for, the fact that he does eventually give it back. But then he's immediately arrested in Florence.
Right.
But I love how you tell about how there's kind of a mob scene in Florence when the Italians have it back for a time. They give it back to Paris fairly soon, but everyone comes to see it in Florence.
It's the first time it had been back in Florence since Leonardo painted it in the early 1500s. So you're talking, you know, 400 years. It was the event of the day. 30,000 Florentines went to see it the first day, and the ones who couldn't get in ended up rioting. It was there for a week, and then it made a little mini tour of Italy to Rome for another 8 days, I believe, and then up to Milan for a day, and then finally back to the Louvre. It had to go back to Paris because it was still French national property.
Mention that, though. That's important. It wasn't, in fact, a looted painting.
No.
Leonardo sold it to the French.
No, exactly. Leonardo – well, there's a lot of discussion about when it was – you know, did the king, you know, take it?
Yeah.
Did the king buy it from Leonardo? Did he buy it from Leonardo's heirs? Perugia, who saw a movie – and I tracked down this movie.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I would love to find a print of it, but I found the written description of it, and it says that King Francis I fell in love with the Mona Lisa, and the actual Mona Lisa, and he couldn't have her, so he took the painting.
Huh.
And that's how why Perugia thought that, you know, the French had it, because he had seen a film.
Wow. But that raises another question.
Right.
And that is, what do you figure was his relationship with that painting? I mean, because as people say, in one person says that it cast a spell over him.
Right.
I think he himself says he fell in love with the painting. What do you think? I mean, and in some ways, he has had an experience that none of us ever will. Especially people, if you go to the Louvre today, it is packed, that place. You barely get a shot of the Mona Lisa itself. He had it to himself for 2 years. And so what do you figure his relationship was like with that thing?
Well, I think in the beginning, once he stole it and he saw the newspaper headlines, I thought he got scared.
Yeah.
Probably. Mm. And maybe at that point is when he pawned it off on his friend to hold. I think he was probably amazed at what he had done. But I think after a while, he had it for 2.5 years. How many times have we gotten, you know, a prized possession? You know, I'm a guitar player, and I remember the first real nice Gibson guitar I got. You play it every day, and then after a while, it's sort of like it gets put in the closet.
Yeah.
I think after 2.5 years, he was tired of it. He wanted to get rid of it. And he did write some letters to try to get rid of it. And we found those letters in the Florence archives.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think this is such a, I have to say, one of the most sort of touching parts of your documentary. You make this this promise to his daughter that you're going to find out what the motive was, why he did this. Her hunch is that he did it because of patriotism. And then you find these letters, which offer a more it reveals that he was in it in many parts for the money. He wanted to make his fortune in some ways.
Right. I knew going in that Perugia had gone to London to see an art dealer named Duveen, who's one of the biggest art dealers of the day. I knew that he had written a letter to an art dealer in Florence now named Alfredo Getty.
Yeah.
I found, which I didn't know, and which a lot of people don't bring out in their books, that he had written this first letter he wrote to a magistrate in his area saying, I have the Mona Lisa. I want to return it to Italy. And because you are a well-respected politician, if you help me do this, I'm sure this will help you get reelected. So Perugia was working that angle. Mm. But he also wrote in every letter that I saw, he wanted to be compensated. He wanted a reward. It wasn't quite, you know, he didn't never set a dollar figure.
No.
He didn't say, you know, I'll give you the Mona Lisa if you give me $500,000. It was always, I want to be compensated. So, yes, the money was always there. And when we found the letters in the archives, and this was really just quite a stroke of luck. We were in Florence to visit the hotel room where he had stayed with the Mona Lisa.
Right.
We stumbled upon the prison where he was arrested. And my Italian translator said, I arranged for us to go to the archives. And I said, well, what's in the archives? I've got thousands of documents from the Paris archives, the police reports, his mugshots. What do the Italian archives happen to have? Well, they had some details from his trial. It's like, okay, this is good.
I've seen it.
But then I found the letters that he had written to his parents that the police had seized when they raided his parents' home in Demenza. And, of course, you know, the ones before the theft – he's talking about, you know, how's my brother doing? I don't like the job he has. Thanks, Dad. Thanks for sending the salami.
Right.
but after the theft, he doesn't say, "Hey, guess what I did?" But he's basically telling his parents, "Something's coming that's going to be good for us all. I have a secret. I can't tell you what it is. But next year, I'm no longer going to be working in Paris. I'm going to be able to come home to you all, and I'm going to have a fortune." And this fortune is going to be for all of our benefits.
Yeah.
So he was really hoping that the government – this is what I believe. I don't think it was as crass as, I'm going to steal this painting. Let me sell it to the highest bidder.
No.
Because he didn't get caught doing that. I feel that he genuinely believed that the paintings were stolen in Italy. Maybe the monkey wrench got thrown into his plans when he read that possibly the Mona Lisa wasn't stolen.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why he kept it for 2.5 years. But I think he did want money. This was his ticket. This was his way of securing a better life for himself and his family.
Yeah. We're pretty much out of time, but I want to ask you this finally, because this is where you sort of the conclusion you come to about Perugia's sort of motive, that it was complicated, but you talk about how you can relate to it, how someone who's striving to make their way for their family, you get it in that way, and finally you come around to kind of connecting to him again personally.
I stumbled on a journal entry because I was always keeping a journal back when I was first writing my screenplay, and I wrote the line quite naively, if I write the script and sell it, I will be rich.
Yeah.
You know, I'll be able to pay off my house and do things for my family. And it was like, I'm saying the same thing at my age that Perugia was saying, and we were a similar age. So I think it's a function of a young man trying to make his way in the world. Of course, he did it totally the wrong way,
sure,
but he believed that he was doing the right thing.
Joe Medeiros. He's a writer, director, and producer of the documentary film called The Missing Piece. He joined us here in the studio. Joe, thank you very much.
Thank you. And anybody who wants to sign up and find out when our documentary is released, we're at MonaLisaMissing.com.
We'll put a link, by the way, okay. on our website
Great.
As well.
Thank you.
Joe, thanks. Our thanks to Tim Slover today. The program is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, don't you love me? If you don't you love me, I don't you. Mona Lisa, with a face just like a pizza, and a shape, what a look, just like pasta fazool. I'm